Hey guys, I'm Adam Rapport, and this is the Bon Appetit Foodcast. All right, before we get started, we are planning an upcoming episode all about peak summer cooking with Carla Music and our friend Gabe T and me. And we'd love for you to send us your questions. So if you got any inquiries about grilling or what to do with all that amazing produce at the farmer's market, I don't know, summer entertaining perhaps, hit us up. You can send any and all questions to bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. And we will do our best to answer them on this episode, which will come out mid-July. So once again, bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Send us your summer cooking questions. All right. For today's show, conventional wisdom tells us to marinate before we grill. However, this summer we got to thinking, doesn't it actually make sense to marinate after you grill? I chat with Carla Music about this, a new story in our June-July issue. And then Emil Stonick is in studio to go over the essentials of charcoal grilling, how to get your flames going, how to maintain them, and how to build that crucial two-zone fire. And one quick note, I just want to remind you that so much of the content on this podcast comes from the stories we write for our magazine. So if you want to support that and get these recipes and stories in your hands, you can go to bonappetit.com/getthemag and subscribe for a $10 one-year subscription, and you get a cool tote bag too. That is bonappetit.com/getthemag. We would love your support. Now, let's do this. Here is Carla and me. Carla.
Adam.
Marinate after grilling.
Marinate after grilling.
After.
That's right. It's kind of like moisturizing after sunbathing. You know,
oh.
You get your time in the sun and you need to like enhance and amplify.
It's interesting you mentioned that because like I do the moisturizer every morning with the SPF.
Great.
And then if you are going out in the sun, like playing golf or something, by the time you're done, you get back home, like your face is dry and it's thirsty.
That's right.
It's thirsty for moisturizer, so you have to put more moisturizer. And theoretically, if it's summertime, you should probably have SPF in it anyways, right?
You should be doubling down on the SPF.
Do you ever do the aloe sort of thing?
Sure.
That's like it seems like if you're burnt or whatever, it's really intense sun.
Yeah.
Yeah. So marinating's like SPF moisturizing.
A little bit.
Yeah. Infusing with goodness.
I think it's like after the, so what we're talking about is proteins that have been grilled with very little seasoning. And then.
Well, not necessarily little seasoning, which is very basic. Salt and pepper.
Very basic. Salt and pepper. Yeah. Not like a whole rigmarole.
Yeah.
And that after these proteins are cooked, they are kind of primed to absorb flavor.
Yes.
And the beautiful thing about marinating after grilling is that the marinade becomes part of the dish. When you marinate before grilling, you really have to discard that marinade because it's got raw meat juices.
So growing up, Maxine would always, she would have like this flank steak recipe. We've talked about this before. And she'd have like the soy sauce and the ginger and the honey. And the flank steak would bathe in that for a couple hours in one of those Pyrex sort of dishes that moms had back in the day.
Still do.
And then you'd grill it. And then that stuff would just get tossed out. And you'd have a tasty steak, but you're like, well, where's all the sauce? Where was all that good stuff? And you're like, oh, it's down the sink.
That's right.
So with this case, what we're sort of preaching here, and this came by way of the great Claire Saffitz, who pitched this story in an ideas meeting. As soon as she said the words marinate after grilling, I was just like, yes, done, assigned. I don't even know what the recipes are, but I am so into that because this is kind of a form of escabeche.
Correct.
Which is sort of what this dates back to. Unless, can you explain escabeche? Because with anything cooking-wise, we're not really inventing anything new. We're just sort of shining a light on stuff that deserves a spotlight.
Yeah. So we were definitely inspired by like the classic escabeche, which when I started digging into where does escabeche come from this morning before recording the podcast, I was like, oh, well, I could devote the next month of my life to figuring this one out. But it really is credited to Spain. But has migrated to a lot of like Latin America countries. But really the Moors brought it to Spain in the 800s via North Africa. It's totally crazy. And then origins of the escabeche word are found in, there's a Persian word for that's like very similar to escabeche with roots. So I was in a whole etymological K-hole this morning. But essentially what it is it's very common with fish. So a cooked piece of fish that would then be put down into a vinegary mixture. Vinegar could be lemon juice, some onions, and really when you do escabeche, you would put the flesh side down into that marinade and it would really absorb because skin is kind of like a waterproof layer in a way. Yeah. So you like put it down and it absorbs all of those flavors into the protein and I'm sure it was also a preservation method and like all of that kind of stuff. But if you think about ceviche, there's also a connection there of like taking protein, whether raw or cooked, and then bathing it in this like vinegary mixture. So similar to ceviche, you have your proteins. They're hanging out in this really nice vinegary bath and taking on a ton of flavor that then becomes part of the dish. And I think also when the proteins are resting in your marinade, you know, the meat juices that like come out when it's resting.
And then they're on the cutting board.
And then they're on the cutting board.
And you don't get them back.
Right. That's right. And a lot of this ends up also in that marinade. So it's just a great, and they're really beautiful and they can hang out for a while. So I think that what I love is that the flavor ends up on the plate. And just like you said, with marinating before grilling, you need an incredibly concentrated mixture. You need a lot of time. And then there's a lot of times that once you add the kind of smoky flavors from the grill, you're like, I don't even taste the marinade.
Exactly.
You know?
So let's talk about some specific recipes. We did a snapper escabeche with charred scallions a few years ago. We shot a video for it even. And I think what was cool about this recipe is it was skin on snapper fillets. A couple points here. Like typically unlike red meat, you're not going to marinate fish beforehand, unless it's tuna. But usually, especially white fish like this, it's too delicate. It's going to break down and get mushy and whatnot. So you just grill it with salt and pepper. And what I really liked about this recipe is that you get that skin really crispy and that nice charred flavor. And then you have a really simple marinade, or basically just, I've talked about this before, it's just essentially a salad dressing. You've got olive oil, some red onion, some white wine vinegar. You let that hang out, the onions sort of mellow, and then you just bathe it, the hot fish, crispy charred skin, and that acidic bath just plays so nicely off the char flavor, and it sort of infuses the white fish, which can be pretty mild flavored, all of a sudden with a lot of flavor.
Totally. And it can also go a little bit dry, you know?
Yes.
Especially with grilling, which, you know, if you're grilling over medium high heat, it's pretty aggressive dry heat. And that too just adds that, like, it does. It absorbs that fat and that liquid.
So let's talk. All right, so we have this recipe for soy sauce marinated grilled flank steak in scallions in the June issue of Bon Appetit.
Sounds a little bit like Maxine's recipe.
It's not unlike Maxine's recipe. So the post-grill marinade is, we've got some olive oil, we've got quarter cup mirin with sweet Japanese rice wine, quarter cup soy sauce, we have some brown sugar, some white vinegar, a little bit of sriracha, and we've got some toasted sesame oil. So with this, you season the flank steak.
Simply,
but liberally.
Sure.
You know, good amount of salt. It's a big, thick piece of red meat, and you get that nice, crispy char on it. Because you also mentioned earlier when we were talking, another danger of, not a danger, but something to consider when marinating beforehand is that you have a very moist, wet piece of meat.
Right.
That does not yield you a nice, crispy char typically, right?
Yeah, and if you're thinking about the recipes that will tell you to pat dry before grilling, or, you know, the drier the skin, the better the sear. So then you're taking something out of like, a liquid, and then you're like, well, now it's saturated with liquid.
Yeah.
And it might stick because the marinade, you know, that's another thing that happens with marinades that have sugar in them. If you think about like barbecue sauce that you might put on chicken before grilling, the sugars in marinades burn. And that's another challenge for the griller. So in this scenario, you have a steak with salt and pepper. You don't have the wet problem.
Yeah,
you don't have burn problem.
You're going to get a nice crust. It's not going to burn. And then what I like about this also, so you get your steak, nice crispy crust, perfect medium rare, you slice it first and then you bathe it with this soy sauce marinade, so that soy sauce marinade penetrates each slice, right?
Totally. And you resting it when it comes off the grill, and then putting it into the marinade. And this marinade has kind of a little bit of everything. It's got some sweet flavors. It's got salty flavors. I really like distilled white vinegar. It's only a small amount.
Can we talk about white vinegar?
Yeah.
I'm always like, oh, is that something you're supposed to clean your whatever with?
Yeah.
Like, are you supposed to, it feels like white vinegar was something like my grandmother used.
Yeah.
And like nowadays, I got to have a fancy vinegar in my cupboard.
White vinegar is fantastic.
And like, it's for like, what though? Like, what am I using
OG
it for?
It's the OG pickling vinegar, right?
Okay.
Just like, and it is just so acidic.
And you just and have like, those basic little glass bottles of it you see in the
just
supermarket.
Just your Heinz or your whatever. Like very clean, very sour, very acidic. Great for pickling, but great in this too. I make a there's a salsa verde recipe that I used to make all the time that also had white vinegar. And the first time I was like, can we do a little bit better than that?
Can we get
like,
some
fancy? Come on.
I have this great bottle of Sonoma champagne vinegar that I got in a gift basket.
Come on, my unseasoned rice vinegar? No, but it's like, you know, in the spectrum of acidity, it's like very high acid. So it's a little bit, it goes a long way, but it doesn't add like any of those sweet flavors. It's not adding any like barrel agedness.
Yeah,
there's no like woodsiness to it. It's just like clean, sour in your face.
And it's not balsamic, which is really going to lean really sweet and balsamic. But let me ask you a question. Like, I know we with our recipes that we tested BA, we're very specific. You guys in the test kitchen, you'll go through many rounds to get it dialed in and is just right. But if I'm a home cook and I'm like, you know what? I don't have any white vinegar. I do have some unseasoned rice wine vinegar. If it's just 2 tablespoons, I can use that too,
of
right?
Of course.
I mean, unless it's balsamic or something leans, takes it in a different flavor direction.
Totally.
Whether it's, you know, Bragg's apple cider vinegar or rice wine vinegar, it's close enough, right?
I totally think that that is true. I think in this case, the white vinegar, the only thing I would say is, as a home cook, you're like, white vinegar, that's like one of the punchier ones.
Yeah.
Whereas rice vinegar is like a milder vinegar.
Which
so you might think about.
Which is the reason why I love it for salad dressings.
Right.
Because it's
but
a little bit sweet, but not overly sweet. And it's not going to overpower like a delicate green.
Sure. But I think in this case, it needs to be something to cut through. There's mirin and there's brown sugar. So you do have these sweet ingredients that you need to temper. So if you had red wine vinegar, I would say that's like more sour than rice vinegar.
Yep.
But dude, I wrote a whole book about making substitutions and recipes, so I am 100% down with vinegar is vinegar is vinegar.
You literally wrote a whole book.
No, I literally
you
did.
You literally did. What's your book called again, Carla, for the listeners at home?
It's called Where Cooking Begins, Uncomplicated Recipes to Make You a Great Cook.
So how does that came out when?
That came out in March.
How is it done, like, on the Amazon? Let's be honest, sidebar here. Like, how often do you go in to check out, like, your ranking and that sort of stuff?
I probably these days check, like, once a week.
And it's one of those. Come on, be honest.
Well, no, really, it's like one of those things that I'm like, when I should be going to bed, and I'm like, all right, I checked Instagram, and I checked Twitter, and I checked my email again, and I, like, checked the New York Times again, so there was an update. Oh, I know. I'll also check Amazon. If I get a little press or something happens, I'll go look and see how the rankings change.
How much of an ebb and flow has there been on rankings? Has it gone up and down, or has it been pretty consistent? Or how does that work?
Oh, I mean, like when it comes out, you're like high in the rankings because all of the pre-orders ship. So then you get this like all of the any order that anybody placed leading into the publication all ship at the same time.
Okay, so
that
like load.
Yeah. You know, like, I was like number 7 and it was amazing. And now I'm like in the 2000s, you know.
In what category? How's it
done? There's like all books. Uh-huh. There's a bunch of categories. So I'm still like in the 30s in like U.S. regional cooking or like cooking for 1 and 2. There's these weird categories.
Cooking for 1 and 2.
Yeah. But like
new
releases, I'm not in the top 50 anymore.
Because,
but then overall.
But are you even considered a new release anymore?
I don't
kind
know.
Of. I wonder what that cutoff is. Like, is it
a
twice? Probably twice a year.
3 or 4 months.
Because cookbooks typically come out in fall and spring, so they probably do new releases.
Anyway, some great grilling recipes in there.
Are there really?
Yeah.
Okay.
A few.
You got the steak and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see this. So, Where Cooking Begins, ladies and gentlemen, you can buy it on. Let's support some of your small bookstores.
Yeah, all of the
please.
Local bookstores. And if you want a signed copy,
ooh.
I believe there's still signed copies at Now Serving, which we've written about in Bon Appetit. Great little cookbook store in LA.
Okay, so I'm not gonna say I have an issue with this story because I love this story, and we've got a grilled chicken with lemon and thyme, and I love something with grilled chicken skin on. That also gets back to that point where with skin on, the skin stays dry. You can get a nice crispy skin on it, which and whatnot before you sort of bathe it. I'm gonna stop using the word bathe before you sort of pour on the marinade. Mm-hmm. We've got some jalapeno marinated grilled pork chops.
Yeah.
Okay, so the marinade is olive oil. Super simple. Some coriander seeds, some apple cider vinegar, a little bit of sugar, and some jalapenos.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I wrote a couple years ago about our friend Gabe about how he was doing some like grilled pork with sort of a nok cham sauce with like the lime juice and fish sauce, and we had some little garlic and this and that in there and a little sugar. And I started grilling pork chops. And then after grilling, sort of pouring this sauce all over it. It's kind of a marinade, a vinaigrette of sorts. And it was delicious. However, the last time I was grilling like a month ago with our friends at Eight Hands Farm out in the North Fork of Long Island.
I saw those pork chops on your Instagram.
They were amazing. Check out my Instagram. But now, can we talk about now I'm just at Rappaport? It's no longer at Rappo4.
I know. This was very scandalous when you did this.
Was it though?
I mean, I wasn't scandalized. I was more
Emma,
like,
did you have an opinion one way or the other? No, she's like, meh.
Who cares?
I don't know. Our friend Eva Chen over at Instagram was like, you need to change your handle.
Why?
I don't know. She made a whole thing about it wasn't professional enough. Like, at Rappaport, it's like, people don't know that's you. It's like, you have a name. Like, you are an editor of this magazine. Like, it should just be at Rappaport. I can get you that handle. No, so it's been unused for like 3 years. Huh. Or it's been dormant. I guess someone had it, but it was a dormant account.
Huh.
So I was like, okay.
I know the four was like a jersey number or something.
When I played high school basketball, that was my jersey number.
Okay, recall for me.
Yeah, because it's amazing. Because at the time, Adam Rappaport, whatever, those regular handles
you
weren't available.
Get. Yeah. But for me, the four always was like the port, you know? It like sounds like port, Rappaport.
Interesting.
I don't know if that was intentional. Emma's like, we have 30 minutes to talk about marinating. The two of you to get on program.
We have a lot of tangents today.
However,
grew up these beautiful heritage breed pork chops from Eight Hands the other day. I made a little sort of riff on nok cham. Had a couple friends over. We're hanging out. The thing is, in this instance, the pork chops were so good on their own with just the salt and pepper and that sweet fat cap and milky white and just juicy, a perfect medium/medium rare. And I was like, you know what? I'm not going to put any sort of marinade or sauce on them. They were too good on their own. And I think there are times where, as obsessed as we get about marinades and dry rubs and all that sort of things, I do think there are instances where salt and pepper is all you need.
Sure. I agree.
You know, if you're going to buy a $40 ribeye, I don't want a soy sauce marinade on that.
Sure. As you wish. It's your dinner.
I'm asking you, are you of the similar school or do you always like to hop it up somewhat?
I think that in the example you're describing, that pork is very special. And like most pork, like, you know, rib chops are very lean and like they don't have a ton of internal marbling and like they do benefit from all of this. But I also think that as cooks, that tapping into that intuition and your gut is like, that's what it's all about. So if you didn't think it needed it, then it didn't need it. Or also maybe you just needed a change. Or you could have served it on the side. And if people wanted to dilly dally over there and dabble, then they could.
But I think that's what your book gets at, which I like about your book, is that it endorses riffing. It endorses trusting your instincts and sort of gut as a cook. And so I guess in this instance, jalapeno marinated grilled pork chops, like that's kind of a game time decision for me. It's like, all right, am I just getting regular okay pork chops from the butcher's case? And you can go to Whole Foods or wherever, you see them sometimes, you're like, okay, that looks fine, but it looks pretty lean. There's no marbling like you see in a good ribeye or something. There's very little fat cap. That's gonna need some flavoring.
That might benefit from, it's just gonna get better.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's why these things that we're doing are tricks. You could have bread and butter, or you could have like bread and salted butter with shaved radishes and jammy eggs.
Mm.
Bread and butter on its own is great.
If you have really good bread.
If you have really good bread and butter. But then you might want to take it up a notch.
Yeah.
I think that is, I don't think it would have been bad But I think in what you're describing, you wanted to preserve the kind of like, let's just enjoy this for how perfect this ingredient is.
Yeah. You know what? I think.
Did you put any like squeeze of lime or any kind of? I do like little lemon or lime on like a simply grilled great piece of pork or beef.
Yeah, I like that sometimes with like, you know, Italian styles where they'll have like the little lemon wedges next to the
tagliata.
Yeah, next to the porterhouse steak and just add a little acid to otherwise fatty piece of meat. I think this technique plays really well with grilled vegetables, actually, or at least certain grilled vegetables. We have a recipe with grilled summer squash, aka like zucchini, red onions, and a little sort of shaved feta cheese.
You just wrote about grilled squash in your newsletter. And I had written about squash in my newsletter a year ago.
How do you subscribe to the newsletter, Emma? Oh, boy.
It's like bonappetit.com/newsletters. I'm making that up.
Okay. So you can follow Carla and me. We each do a newsletter. I do mine on Monday. Carla, you're Thursday or Wednesday?
Mine comes out Wednesday night. So I always have to ask what you wrote about because you go first.
I got dibs. So it's bonappetit.com/newsletter/subscribe. And we each sort of endorse a recipe, give you a little anecdote each week. And then we have Alex Beggs, who writes about all sorts of crazy stuff on Fridays about what's going on at the office. So yeah, definitely subscribe to the newsletters. They're actually a lot of fun. Highly recommend them. So zucchini, both of which you and I have a sort of a challenge relationship with. You've gone so far to say you hate it, with a few exceptions. When you grill zucchini, especially if you're doing those little slices, it just does not taste like much. You're
it is
just like,
literally water. It's water with like a shape.
Exactly. So we
that's
have
it.
This recipe here where we've got the oil and the vinegar. I've done it where I've grilled the zucchini. Then I've got some, like, if there's anything pickled in the fridge, from like pickled jalapenos to pickled ramps, I'll sort of scatter those on top with some of that pickling juice, you know, and then maybe some chopped up almonds or hazelnuts or something, throw that on there.
Yeah.
But you want that oil and pickling juice, something vinegary to infuse that otherwise bland vegetable with flavor. And that happens with a lot of grilled vegetables. They look nice, and then you eat them, you're like, yeah, these grilled mushrooms taste like, eh.
Dirt water.
Yeah. So it's like, I think this is a really cool technique. Grill, and also, again, it's easier to grill. You don't want to be grilling wet zucchini. You want to be grilling zucchini just with a little oil and salt. That's
fine. Yeah,
the
second you cut it, it just like makes water.
Exactly. So highly endorse marinating after grilling with grilled vegetables because they need a little help more so than, like I said, a pork chop, a good pork chop, a good steak. There's so much intrinsic flavor in there, you know, so I think that's a great technique.
Yeah,
for that.
This is a little bit of a sassed up version, but it's exactly what you just described. There's hot peppers with their liquid, their pickling liquid, garlic, more vinegar, the red onions, and then it's got feta. And as we all know, feta makes it better.
Yes. I'm sure you made that joke in your book, right?
I didn't. I made.
Really?
I used that headline though in a prep school like 100,000 years ago, and I literally was glowing for a week. I was like, I can't believe they let me print it.
That wasn't because you went to the dermatologist this morning.
No, that I'm glowing.
Yeah.
No, I'm like retroactively glowing that feta makes it better actually is in print.
All right. Any parting thoughts on marinade after grilling? Anything we should know in terms of sort of handling this?
I would just say if you like the idea of marinating, but you've been disappointed, you need to flip the script and marinate after.
And do it. It's never not going to be good. Again, you get all that flavor. And also what I really like about it, is it looks beautiful.
It looks really beautiful.
Those pooling little, and you get the little sort of eyelets of the oil and the vinegar, and you got the weather, and then the little maybe the steak juice sort of seeping in
totally.
There.
Yeah, and there will be enough marinade from all of these that if you're also serving like beautiful sliced tomatoes or a simple green salad or some other, that all of that, you know, I like to think about like how the sauces, when everything touches each other on the plate, what's going to happen? And you're going to have like sauce to spare.
All right, now I'm hungry. It's 12 noon. Let's go eat some lunch.
Perfect timing.
Carla Music, thank you very much. You listeners, you can find these recipes in the June grilling issue of Bon Appetit on stands now or check them out on bonappetit.com. Thanks, guys. Okay, so Emil, the irony is that we're doing a podcast on charcoal and I literally just bought a gas grill.
Well, I mean, you know, it's not either or. I feel like that's the real thing. You didn't throw out your charcoal grill, did you?
I still have my charcoal grill. And the reason I bought a gas grill is because I was using my charcoal grill so much that it annoyed my upstairs neighbors in the apartment building who didn't like these plumes of smoke sort of wafting into their windows. And I'm a considerate guy, and I'm like, that's a good point. Can't argue with you. I'll get another option.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's the thing. You know, you want options. And, you know, I think the reason that we decided to focus on charcoal grilling for this basically theme was kind of like the gas grills are great for a lot of reasons. It's really convenient. You just like turn it on. It's good to go. It's great for that kind of like weeknight moment where you're just like trying to cook three burgers and then call it a night. But charcoal grilling is like the barrier to entry is much lower. I think you don't need to spend, you know, $300 on a grill and get the propane. But the thing is, you can go, you know, if you want to grill this weekend in the park, you go to the Home Depot, you drop like $30 on one of those little Jumbo Joes.
Basic 22,
a bag of charcoal, and you're good to go.
Your basic 22-inch Weber, which is your standard kettle grill, which I own and everyone owns, and they're sort of unimpeachable. I mean, those are like $100 maybe max, I think now. Barrier to entry is lower, but the nuances of using them are a lot more sort of intricate than a gas grill.
Right.
And there's a lot to master, so to speak.
Right. And so, you know, there are a few things that you kind of do need to know and think about if you are, you know, the kind of person who's got the little charcoal grill stashed in your closet and you take it out whenever you want to, you know, grill some dogs
in the
park.
So let's start at the beginning. Let's start with starting the fire, because I was saying there's something like Pavlovian about that. When you smell the charcoal, smoke, you're like, oh, it's summertime. I'm grilling. I'm getting myself a drink and I'm going to go stand outside with a pair of tongs in my hand and just look at the fire.
Totally. I mean, there is that first night, and it's normally like in May or something like that, when it's kind of like it's nice outside. You're walking around. You're like, what is that smell? Ah, it's summer.
Yes.
Like somebody is grilling.
Okay. So start the fire. Talk to me.
All right. Well, I mean, the first thing, and I feel like this is, you know, we made this the first point because it feels like the most important tenet of Bon Appetit charcoal grilling is no lighter fluid ever. No lighter fluid in a bottle, no lighter fluid impregnated charcoal briquettes, that none of the match light charcoal. You don't need lighter fluid to start your charcoal, and you don't want it because it, you know, no matter how odorless they say it is or whatever, you still smell it, you still taste it. You don't need to add chemicals.
Although,
I
love the smell of gas stations and the smell of gasoline at a gas station, I also love the smell of, like, there's something about park picnics when people are starting their grill and they always have that sort of stuff because they don't have a charcoal chimney with them, which we'll talk about in a second. But I'm like, oh, yes, lighter fluid cookout.
Yeah.
With your little, like, suitcase grill and everything. All right, so anyway, so at home, we don't want all those chemicals, so how are we starting on the grill?
So instead, all you need is a charcoal chimney, which costs less than $20. You'll have it for years and years and years, and it's super lo-fi. Basically, what you're looking at is a, you know, probably a foot tall metal cylinder that's got a handle on it, and it's got like a inside, you know, probably like, you know, 4 inches from the ground, like a little mesh or like coil, something to kind of keep the charcoal elevated. You dump your charcoal in, you put a wad of newspaper or a paper bag or something underneath it, light it. And what it's going to do is it's going to draw the air and the fire up through that cylinder and ignite all of your charcoal kind of like in a big stack. And it's like ready in 20 minutes.
I don't know who invented the charcoal chimney, but I think he or she should get a Nobel Prize. It's fascinating when you light that first match and there's that little wisp of newspaper sticking out through one of the slots on the side. Within 5 seconds, literally, smoke is just emanating from the thing. Like that, there's something about the physics of the air circulating from the bottom to up, and it just goes, and all of a sudden, that charcoal is going. It does take, I would say, while the fire starts immediately and the charcoal starts to smoke immediately, to get them to temperature where they're sort of that glowing orange,
right,
where they're ready to dump into your kettle grill, that's more like 15 minutes. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I'd say from kind of start to, from the time that you light the newspaper underneath the charcoal to cooking time, I'd say, or like the hottest possible cooking time is probably, 15, 20 15 to 25 minutes.
So when you'll have this canister full of coals, there will be flames coming up, but you want the majority of the coals that sort of glowing orange.
Right.
You're ready to dump. Two things. One issue I have is the size of the chimney, which is beautifully designed because it works remarkably, so I'm not going to complain about that. But I do think that you often need more than just one chimney full. Like, what I'll typically do is I'll fill up the chimney and I'll continue to pour coals on so they kind of spill over onto the grate, because you set the charcoal grill on the bottom grate.
Right. That's a really great point. Grill. You ideally, what you do is you have your charcoal grill set up, you take the grate off.
The top grate that you grill food on.
The top grate off. The lid off, top grate off, and you've got your charcoal chimney in there.
Yeah.
So you don't have to like burn a patch of grass or whatever.
But I always add some extra coals to that bottom grate so they kind of catch as the thing's going. Other people I know have two charcoal chimneys, and they might have another charcoal chimney going on a patch of concrete or something. We've done this for video shoots where we need to sort of replenish the coal. So that's just one thing to consider. Like, always be on the generous side. Like, you're going to want a little bit more than what fills up the chimney itself.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, this is it's an art, not a science.
Yes.
And you know, much depends on the size of your grill.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got that standard, I find that the standard kind of 22-inch Weber grill, one charcoal chimney, like loaded, you know, kind of mounded with charcoal, is going to probably get you where you're going. But definitely, I mean, I'm a huge advocate for starting a second round of charcoal. You know, maybe like once you get the first things on the grill, just fire another one.
Yeah.
You know, because then, you know, depending on what you're cooking and how long you're planning on cooking, you're probably going to want to keep grilling 45 minutes from now.
Yeah.
You know, if it's kind of one of those like long rolling cookout sort of situations.
Friends coming over and you're putting various things on the grill.
Right, right. You just want to be ready and you don't want to have to be like, hold on, we gotta do another charcoal chimney. It's gonna be another 30 minutes before you're
okay. I know we're not using like the fluid soaked briquettes, and this is something I've gone back and forth on over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Classic charcoal briquettes like Kingsford versus like the hardwood lump shards of charcoal that I feel like kind of came into favor among the average schmoes like us like a decade ago or so. Talk to me about the difference of them, and is there one that you prefer?
Okay. So, I mean, again, I don't think this is an either or sort of situation. I think each one is better for different things. Your Kingsford like classic charcoal briquettes, you know, the little like nugget shaped ones that have like the K on them. Those are going to burn really, really consistently and for a long time. So that's kind of my go-to when I just want even, controllable heat. I am going to be grilling for maybe a couple of hours, so I'm going to be replenishing my charcoal a few times, and I want to get the most bang for my buck out of it and know exactly how it's going to perform. That's my go-to. Hardwood lump, on the other hand, it burns a lot hotter and faster, and is probably, you know, I think often, and this is up for debate, but I think also has a little bit more flavor. So like more of that hardwood flavor. The Kingsford briquettes, you know, they are wood, but there's also kind of like some sawdust and some binders in there.
They're compressed into these nuggets, whereas the lump hardwood is actual chunks of carbonized wood.
Totally. And some of those chunks are going to be big. You know, sometimes you get like what looks like a big chunk of log, and sometimes you get some kind of like, you know, the hardwood. Yeah, I was going to say like hardwood lump shake. And that's just going to perform a little bit less consistently. So I feel like that's more like, I think charcoal briquettes are a really good place to start if you're new to grilling. And, you know, even for somebody who's done a lot of grilling, I still kind of turn to that when I want that consistency. But hardwood lump, if I'm going to grill one steak on like a weeknight or something, and I want that like really, really high heat, and it's fine if it burns out in, you know, 25 minutes and it's cool, then, you know, I think that hardwood lump is also...
Yeah, I think it's a little bit more of a high performance sort of product. And again, if you don't need to be grilling for 2 hours, and if also, and we'll get to this in a minute in terms of what you want to cook over what sort of heat, but if you definitely want that high heat for that super crispy, you know, sear crust on your fancy steak, lump is the way to go.
Totally.
But otherwise, I'm pretty much, I don't want to say exclusively, charcoal briquettes these days, but consistently charcoal briquettes because I love the consistency that they deliver.
Well, and I sometimes, you know, if I'm going to be doing a lot of grilling, I'll get a big bag of charcoal briquettes and I'll also have a bag of hardwood lump kind of waiting in the wings. Because sometimes, you know, maybe you're at it, maybe it is that kind of cookout where people are just bringing a bunch of grillables, you know, and, like, you know,
like Boca burgers,
like Boca burgers, you know, some pre-cooked chicken sausages, some skewers from the Whole Foods.
I love the pre-cooked sausages. You're like, oh God.
That's a Brooklyn 20-something grill out for sure. And what I like to do is, you know, if I feel like I need to add a little bit more heat to my briquettes, you know, they're in there and I just kind of want to like add a little bit more, I'll throw in a handful of the hardwood lump, which is going to catch pretty fast. And also, I think, you know, it has a little bit more flavor, so you're going to get a little bit more aromatic smoke. It's not like what you would get if you were throwing actual wood in, but I feel like it's a little closer.
Let's talk about the two-zone fire.
Ooh, the two-zone fire.
I'm a strong proponent of the two zones.
Yeah. So the idea, I feel like we've all kind of been there at a certain point where you're like, you know, you dump your charcoal in, you've just kind of got this like bed of heat, and it's maybe not quite as hot as you want it to be, or maybe it's too hot. You put your steak on, all of a sudden it's engulfed in flames. You don't have anywhere to move it.
You're freaking out. Sweat dripping off your forehead.
So that is just one of the many problems that the two-zone fire solves. So what you're doing when you're creating a two-zone fire is you dump that charcoal, and then you're going to dump it on one side of the grill. So, you know, you're imagining your circle overhead, and you just dump it to one side, and then use your tongs to kind of move most of the coals over to that side, leaving maybe a few on the other side, and kind of piling them up on the side. So what you're doing, and then you put the grate on, let it preheat, and basically what you're doing is you're creating one side for searing that's going to be really hot, and then one side that's going to still be quite hot, but is more your kind of indirect lower heat. So that does a few things. One, if you've got like a big thick steak or sausages, which I think people have a really hard time cooking and making sure they cook through.
Yes, because I'm always worried that like, no one wants underdone sausages, and then I often end up overcooking them, and you have this beautiful, juicy Italian sausage that is now crumbly and dry, and I'm like, oh, I did it again.
Right, so what you want to do is you want to just get those on the hot side. You want to get those on the hot side just to get some color, get some browning on the outside. And then before they start to kind of like spill fat and start these like, you know, flare-ups, you're going to move those over to the cool side.
Can we say geysers?
Yeah,
you know, the geyser, like the fat shoots out, like it squirts out.
Yeah, well, it's good to kind of prick the sausages a little bit too, but, you know, whether it's your sausages or your steak, you're getting the color that you want on the high heat side and then moving them over to the cooler side to finish cooking through. And it's kind of like the way that if you're in your kitchen, you might start something on the stovetop and then move it to the oven at a lower temperature just so that you have a little more gentle heat.
Okay, lots of thoughts. First of all, with the steak, say you've got a nice strip steak or ribeye, the one big advantage that I always feel a charcoal grill has compared to an average gas grill is that there is that very even bed of intense heat, which gives you a beautiful all-over crispy, crusty char on your steak. Whereas a lot of times you see these gas grills and you're just left with those little grill marks on your steak that's like kind of blackened on the strips but then kind of gray in the middle, and that's not a crispy char. It's not that same steakhouse effect, and like most gas grills just don't deliver the heat evenly. They have like three little strips of flame, for instance, and it does not compare to that just bed of intense heat that charcoal offers.
Totally. Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's more like just a wall of heat, and the grates just exist to kind of keep the food elevated above that, versus with the gas grill, I really feel like it is the grates that are getting hot.
Yeah, and they're also thicker, so that's they conduct and transfer the heat as opposed to the heat itself.
Right.
So a couple other things that, depending on flare-ups and whatnot, with a steak, you know, I also think that having that safe side, the low side of the coals, is nice, because when there are flare-ups, you kind of slide it over there, let the flare-ups die down, put the steak back to the hot side, you move it around, and it is a active pursuit. You're not just putting a steak on and timing it for 5 minutes. You're kind of moving it around as it goes.
Totally.
But ultimately, once you get both sides seared, and also the third side, like the fat side or whatever, the edge. I would argue most steaks don't need much more time than that. If you get all over sears going on each side, I never put the top on. Like, right. I think that's, I need to talk to my boy Sam Cass about this, a friend who was like grilling ribeyes with the top on. I'm like, you don't need to put the top on. Like, if you get them seared all over, then maybe just slide them over to the safe side for a little bit with the top off, they're still going to cook through fine.
Sure. Yeah. And that is, I think, a big question. I think people are often like confused about what to do with the lid, whether they want it on, off. I mean, I think that by and large, most of the cooking that I do on a gas, on a charcoal grill, rather, I'm doing with the lid off. And yes, I want to be moving it around. I want to be, it feels like an active process. I want to be looking at that steak and checking it and making sure it's not on fire and whatever.
Which is what's fun about grilling. You're not just set it and forget it.
Totally.
It's a pursuit. It's an active sport. And you're there. You got your drink. You got your tongs. You got your spatula or whatever. And it's like you're doing something.
However, I will say that I feel like there are other sorts of things that you might grill where there are certain instances in which you would want the lid on. So if you've got your two-zone fire set up, maybe you've got a whole spatchcocked chicken. So it's a chicken that's been butterflied. You cut the backbone out and you kind of flatten it. Maybe you grill it, and you know it's got bones. It's going to take a while to cook through, and you want to do that kind of gently. Maybe you want to, you know, sear that on both sides and then move it over to the low side, cover it, and just kind of give it like a, you know, you're basically creating an oven then. You know, you've got the hot air just kind of circulating around and letting that chicken kind of cook through a little bit more gently. I think for something very big and thick that you're trying to cook all the way through, not like a steak where you want it medium rare inside, I think that closing the lid can be a really good option.
Well, I would say the one time I do close the lid is for bone-in chicken. If I have like bone-in chicken pieces that have been marinated or something, I'll start them bone side down.
Bone side.
Bone side. Cook them. And I'm trying to remember if I start them with maybe even with the top on so the fat renders. But you want them cooked through. You don't want them over that direct heat because that's when you end up with that burnt chicken skin as opposed to like a beautifully bronzed sort of crispy chicken skin.
Right. And I think, I think that's a good thing to just bring up that was not in this story, but you do not want your food to be on fire.
No.
If your food is, you don't want...
Heat should be cooking your food, not fire.
Correct. And I think that often people are just like, oh, it's just grilling. Like, I put the chicken thighs, marinated chicken thighs on the grill, and then they just, the flames shoot up, and then they get kind of black, and, you know. But that is going to taste burnt and kind of sooty rather than nicely charred and kind of perfumed with smoke. It's, you don't want actual flames.
Carcinogens and stuff.
Probably.
Is that the right word? I think it is. Maybe.
Who cares?
I don't know. But yeah, bone-in chicken thighs, for instance, we were always talking about those in Bon App, and like you marinate them. Bone side down, let some of that fat render. I don't ever want to start on fat side down because that's what causes flare-ups immediately out of the gate, especially if there's anything sweet in the marinade.
Oh, yeah.
Not over direct heat, perhaps with the top on. And if you do put the top on, this might be obvious, make sure the vents on the top and bottom of your grill are both open. You still need that airflow.
That's a good thing to bring up. And I feel like that is sometimes a little bit mystifying for people. Most people don't know, first of all, that there is a vent on the bottom of the grill. And,
it should be open.
Right. You're cooking with fire. So you need airflow. You need oxygen to keep the fire going. There are a lot of ways that you can mess around with those things, but by and large, the bottom vent needs to be open most of the way. And also, it's important to make sure that if this is a grill you use all the time, that the bottom isn't totally all clogged up with a bunch of like leftover ashes and schmutz from, when you forgot to, cover the grill the last time it rained and whatever. You need that airflow to be circulating from the bottom. And then on the lid, that little dial, you need to open it so that it's
those
most of the way
holes,
open.
Yeah.
That said, at the end, when you're trying to like put that fire out, you close them.
Yes.
And that's going to...
And put the lid on.
And put the lid on, and that's going to suffocate your fire. But if you put that lid on and it's and the vents are closed, you're just going to put your fire out.
Yeah.
So instead of cooking your
food. And I think that's a good point for, and again, this is obvious to anyone who grows a lot, but that with a Weber, you've got that handle on the bottom that you slide back and forth that opens up the vents. But also, if you have a bunch of ashes built up in there, that'll sort of perturb those.
Agitate?
Yeah, that'll sort of agitate the ashes, and then they'll fall into the little catch pan, the drip pan at the bottom. But you want to start off, you want to start grilling theoretically without a big pile of ashes at the bottom of your pan. So
yeah,
you always do that sort of back and forth thing, clean out the grill, clean your grates, and then build your fire.
Totally. Which, you know, is also a good thing to bring up, is the grill brush.
I got a funny DM the other day about a grill brush.
It goes down in the DMs.
Someone DM'd me on the Instagram talking about this story in our June issue of Bon Appetit, talking about how the grill brush is the only grilling tool you really need. And they were saying, while it's true that you do need to always clean your grill, and we advocate for grilling it after you're grilling,
cleaning it after grilling
instead of 2 weeks later when you forgot and everything's gunked on. This person also pointed out that with the metal bristles, oftentimes they get left behind or can get left behind on the grill, and then the food can catch them, and then you're eating the metal bristles. I've never had that happen to me, but I was like, okay, thank you for letting me know.
I feel like if that's happening, you probably need to get a better grill brush or just maybe get a new one or something. But yeah, I mean, I think people really geek out about grill tools. So, you know, there's the whole fancy grill dad tool setup. You know, your 4 foot long tongs, you're like big spatula that's got like a, for whatever reason, like a serrated knife on one side of it. And then there's like a, you know, it's got a bottle opener and, you know, like a long silicone like basting brush or whatever. It's like, you don't need any of that.
Don't forget the giant 3 foot long fork.
Oh yeah, the grilling fork. So you don't need any of those tools.
No, but the grilling fork was like back when my dad would grill in the '70s, and there was like the giant quote unquote London broil steak on the grill that, you know, it's like something from the Flintstones that was about 16 inches by 12 inches and like 2 inches thick, and you need a giant fork to flip it over.
Yeah, there's like '50s like suburban dad like just standing there by the fire smoking a cigarette with like a big piece of meat on a fork. But, you know, the reality is most of the tools that you already have in your kitchen are going to work fine on the grill. So the metal spatula you already have, the tongs that you already have, maybe you want to get a pair that's, you know, a little bit longer than your kind of like, you know, 6-inch ones or whatever.
Yeah, but your basic metal restaurant supply store tongs are great.
Yes, as long as it won't melt, it's good. The one thing that you need that is actually kind of a specialty grilling tool is a grill brush. And, you know, what that is, you know, I'm sure you're familiar. Everybody's familiar with a grill brush. But, you know, it's just a brush that's got metal bristles on it. Normally one side has kind of like a metal scraper sort of thing. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, as soon as your grill is, it's going to be the first thing that you do when you start grilling, when you dump the charcoal in and your grates are hot, you want to give it a good brush before you oil down the grates. And at the end, you know, if you've got gunk on there while it's still hot, you just want to brush to make sure you don't have any bits of food or anything like that stuck, because that, you know, those are going to burn. They're going to, you know, sometimes I have opened people's grills before and just had a moldy grill.
No,
it's like literally just like bits of food that have just been sitting there. It's like, get rid of that.
Yeah. Quick little bit. Last bit. Timing is everything. Kind of what to grill when. When the coals first go on, you talk about things like scallions, grilled scallions, which are, if you have scallions in the house, a little olive oil, salt, always throw them on the grill.
Yeah. I mean, so what we were trying to talk about here was the fact that there is, you know, your grill is different from your stove or your oven. You can't just set it at one temperature and cook things and then change the temperature. It is all happening kind of, the heat is going from extremely hot and almost too hot to cook with to cool, warm, and almost not hot enough to cook on. So, and that's going to take probably about 35 to 40 minutes. So that's kind of your window. So you need to plan what you're going to cook based on what the temperature is looking like in the grill at that particular moment. So in the beginning, right, the first 5 minutes when you've kind of first dumped your charcoal, you put the grate on and it's, you know, good, and the grates are good and preheated. That first 5 minutes, it's almost too hot to put anything on. So that's just things that you want to cook really, really, really quickly. You're just trying to get a quick hot and fast sear on them. Maybe even you're trying to, like, you know, get some char. So yeah, your scallions, anything that you're just trying to get a really, really fast sear on. And then, you know, probably you wait 10 minutes, you know, you're kind of 15 minutes from when you started. That's medium high. That's your sweet spot for things like, you know, skirt steak, a thin steak that you're just going to, like, just sear, kiss on both sides for a couple of minutes and then pull off. Thin chops, boneless chicken thighs, maybe, that you've marinated. And again, if you
also with chicken thighs, sorry, but like chicken thighs or boneless chicken breast, like, you actually want that nice and hot. Like, that should not be a long, you want that nice sort of caramelized char on the outside, because those things are pretty thin that they, you don't want, the worst thing is when you do chicken and it's just on the grill for a really long time and gets kind of rubbery and
And
you want it juicy and crispy on the outside.
And this is also a good time to start some of your larger pieces of meat. So if you do have that 2-inch thick ribeye or strip steak or something, you want to sear it on both sides or on, you know, all four sides or whatever. And then, you know, you're pretty close, and then you're going to move that over to your cool side to finish cooking. Then after that, you know, probably like 25 minutes into this whole process is kind of medium heat, and this is kind of just like your all-purpose, like, this is when you're getting your burgers on, your sausages, your hot dogs, you know, your corn. That's kind of like the just like middle of the road heat that's good for cooking most things.
I would say one thing about burgers, unlike we talked about steak, how you want to maybe pick up that strip steak, move it around, put it on side, flip it on the other side. Burgers, it's optimal if you don't have to move them around, you know, especially because it might be stuck at first until they sort of release themselves from the grill. They're juicy. Like, you don't want that whole flipping, moving. Like, so if you can do them over that medium heat that does not encourage flare-ups,
totally,
that's kind of the optimal situation.
For sure, for sure. And then pretty much after that, you know, it's a case of diminishing returns. You're still going to have heat, but your ability to get that kind of that sear and that, like, you know, just initial, like, hot cooking, you're not going to have so much of that. So this is probably, if you're trying to do more rounds of burgers or steaks or grilled veggies or whatever, you're probably going to want to have that second chimney ready to go to dump in there to kind of, like, get the heat going again. But, you know, if you seared off your whole chicken or your bone-in chicken, maybe it's still hanging out in there on the low heat side, just kind of slowly cooking so it's juicy and tender. You can still use that heat once it's too hot to sear, but you're kind of going to want to have seared something when the grill is still hot.
All right, Emil Stonik, thanks for schooling us on the art of charcoal grilling. You can find this article in the Basically section of the June issue of Bon Appetit on stands now. Thanks, Emil.
Thanks, Adam.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.